True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. I'm Kevin Walter, the host. And True Wealth is brought to you by Coins Plus in Spokane, Washington. Coins Plus is your full-service rare coin and precious metals broker-dealer depository service. We buy and sell all forms of rare coins and precious metals. Been doing it for 20 years. We've dealt in a magnitude of coins and rare coins and precious metals. Many hundreds of millions of dollars. And we are a high volume, low margin dealer. People hear those numbers and they say, oh my gosh, you must be loaded. Well, I wish that were the case. We make a very small margin across the board. Our gross profit is about 4%. If you know what that's our profit before taxes and things like that. But it's just the nature of the beast. And we do appreciate all your loyalty and all the patronage over the years. And trust me, it means a lot to us. We do offer the highest rated privately held depository service in the Northwest United States. I built the building over a decade ago, I guess, now about 12 years ago. And people who know me know I go over the top with everything I do. We overdid our building in every possible way, including size. And it's got, for those of you who haven't been here, we got about a 75, 80 foot high clock tower, a very large brick clock tower building. The clock tower is not artificial. I mean, we can actually go up into it. There's a viewing area up at the top of it. And we are at the crest of the Division Street Hills, so we have quite a view from up there. But the building was built excessively. Part of that is because the EPA required us to clean the top 14 feet of our dirt. Yes, clean my dirt. The property was an old car wash. And car washes, I guess, cause a little bit of dirt and muck and grime. So the owners of it did what was called an Environmental One study, which, you know, basically they made sure it met every single possible requirement of environmental. Fine. When I bought it, it was, you know, fine. Everything was good. They'd already replaced dirt. And there was no major pollution or anything like that. It's just the EPA doing what they do. So after I bought the property, a young lad from the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, everyone's favorite agency, the one that Trump froze and stopped and said no more communication and no more funding for now. They hyper-regulate everything and ruin everybody's lives. A good friend of mine had a big, beautiful project set up down on the Spokane River with condos and docks and, you know, this big open area. They were just building this beautiful shopping area, you know, kind of an open air type situation. And the legal department, the legal students, as a project at Gonzaga, took off after him and started trying to, you know, shut it down and cause a whole bunch of problems and got the EPA involved and put them through the ringer. It's a long story, but basically the family that they were doing it to had a massive endowment at Gonzaga, and the students were unaware. The dean of the legal department found out the hard way, et cetera. It was resolved, but the EPA had caused so much havoc along the way, the project never did resume. So what happened here was this young lad, 26-year-old, I suspect, contacted us and said, we need to do a sieve test on your property. So we came out on a Saturday, and the answer is no. I did not know what a sieve test is, nor did anyone I was working with. Came out on the property, dug. The deal was, we were supposed to dig 14 feet in the ground with a backhoe, fill it with water, and drop these little electronic, all-knowing, computerized, I guess, floating ping pong balls in the water, different colors, and get different readings. So as we start digging, the south end of our lot had big berms of dirt that had been dumped here years ago. And so we start digging, and they find pieces of metal and stuff. And the kid goes, "Stop, stop everything." And we're like, "What?" And he goes, "This is an old landfill." And I'm like, "What?" Well, there was one person who highly objected to us building on the property because he was mad that he didn't get to buy the property, even though he had 10 years to do it, which is another story. And apparently he had, you know, reported something. But anyway, so they said, yeah, this is, you know, a landfill. And, you know, I'm like, we're like, no, it's not. This is a big pile of dirt someone dumped here. So he said, no, you're going to have to clean the top 14 feet of your dirt. And the way you have to do it is you have to take it off site, run it through what's called a grizzly, removing anything bigger than a half of an inch, bring the dirt back, lay it down at six, initially at 6-inch layers, 6-inch to a foot layers. We did 6 inches a foot, 6 inches a foot. And then have approval and put these little flags in and spray deionizer on it. It was a long process. I got lucky. It only cost me $75,000. That might not sound cheap, but in this world it is. So it held up our project a month, you know, typical stuff. So after it got all done, so the dirt had been cleaned twice. We had the best dirt in Spokane County. So that when the building was built, and believe me, we way overbuilt it. But we've had zero settling of any sorts, never will. The dirt was so fine and packed down and so perfect. The building's built rock solid. We did all the foundation base, everything in 12 inches of concrete with excessive rebar, and then we began to build structures within the foundation walls. The floors of our vault are 5 feet thick of concrete and steel, 5 feet of concrete with rebar about every 5 inches. It's unbelievable sight. Somewhere down the road, when everybody forgets what this building was for, somebody's going to buy it and try to remodel it or something and find out that that was a bad choice. My logic as I built this building was, I thought, okay, knowing what I know, how do I keep me out? And so we just built security upon security upon security. We made sure that there were no entrance points anywhere, really, and that any place that may be vulnerable is 16 inches of concrete and steel, and the windows are bullet and bomb-resistant polycarbonates, and we have different corridors in the building that are built. You know, the walls are Kevlar, military-grade Kevlar, 1 3/8 Kevlar, you know, and on it goes, and we have various recording and monitors throughout, so when you're in one area, you can see what's going on in the other. 42 cameras, and our vaults are Class 2 vaults, which are better. Banks use Class 1. Class 3 is the best, what the Fed uses. We're using Class 2 vaults, 18 inches of composite concrete, which replicates 36 inches of poured concrete. And then we wrapped that in 1-inch thick T12 resistant plate steel. And I could go on and on, and with motion surveillance and seismic detectors and heat sensors. And I mean, we really did try to build it to beyond, you know, I guess kind of Hollywood standards in a way. We also designed the showroom so that our counters cover 270 degrees. The balcony covers 180 degrees on one side. There's windows above you. It's just very difficult to hold up. And, you know, you have to have a 360-degree range on two floors, and I think you get my point. But the building is very unique. There's none other like it. We have about 600 safe deposit boxes. I think probably 450 to 500 of them are rented out. Very high security and very unlike a bank, very anonymous, confidential. private. We're dealing in the oldest form of money on planet Earth. It's very important that people understand that, because they don't understand the fact that gold is money, silver is money, hard assets is money. It's not something money, the paper stuff that you carry in your hand every day, that's not money. That is the extension of an old bad habit, a habit that has bankrupted many, many banks. And so what happened in the past was banks would take, you know, first we were on a gold standard, a firm gold standard. Then a process started where banks would take people's gold and silver on deposit, and they would give them a certificate of deposit, a gold or silver certificate. Eventually, that became a little more monetary. It became universal, where they just said, okay, here's 20, each $20 gold piece, you get one of these notes. Each $5, you get one of these. And then eventually a paper currency system was formed. Initially, every piece of currency that came out was backed by money in the bank. So if I gave you, in the early 1800s, a $20 gold certificate, you could go to the bank and turn that in and get your $20 gold certificate. Back way back, they were specific to each bank. In other words, if I put the gold at, you know, the Bank of Cheyenne, Wyoming, First Bank of Cheyenne, Wyoming, that's where that note was redeemable. It still became tradable because people knew it was liquid. We had, you know, the cat. We had a couple bank collapses. I'll just put it that way. There was a period of time we had notes issued by state banks. Those eventually went under, and there was also a period of time where there was private banks all over the place. They went under. And what would happen is the owner of the bank would begin to issue more currency than he had gold or silver to back, because they started to use what's called fractional reserve banking, where they knew that at no time would everybody come and withdraw their money, at least hypothetically, so he could put out extra notes, make some more money, and supposedly never get caught. The money, often what I mean is it was put out in the form of loans. So you'd go sign a loan document, you'd get a $100 loan and put up collateral, and he'd give you, you know, 10 $10 gold certificates or whatever it was, and they began to issue too many. They didn't have the gold to back it. What happens was, as time goes on, debts begin to go bad. You know, times change. People try to get their deposits out. Suddenly, these banks are out of money, and they can't produce. They fold the doors. The guy leaves town, and everybody loses their money because the bank owner took it. This stuff went on and on. Eventually, we went through all kinds of U.S. notes under Abraham Lincoln, legal tender notes. They've tried everything. And what's really important to understand about paper money, folks, is that our founding fathers forbade it. Thomas Jefferson said specifically they had literally just gone bankrupt on the continental currency. The colonial currency went bankrupt. They started to print fiat currency to fight the war. They pumped it out way too much, and it became worthless. Great Britain was counterfeiting it, even though it said to counterfeit is death. Great Britain was not afraid of that, and they produced far too much of the currency. Right before the Constitutional Congress, they went full-blown bankrupt. Thomas Jefferson said that it was a providential event, and what he said was, the experience of paper money going bad was one of the best things that ever happened. And the reason he said that was because he knew it was worthless, and he was trying to form, they were trying to form the greatest country in U.S. history, or in the world history. And so they basically said all currency must be gold or silver, period. And they said, this is how it works. This is the breakdown. They said Congress shall control it. And that control shall never leave Congress's hands. And they thought that they set up a system that was timeless and impenetrable. Well, as we've seen over time, people forget things, especially things called the Constitution. Post-Civil War, this nation saw terrible times. We'd lost such a large percentage of adult males, father-aged males, that women, no offense, but they took over the country. They began to push for women's rights to vote and all that. People really twist these historical facts around. It wasn't that women weren't allowed to vote because they were the weaker sex. That is not what it was about. It was a lot about culture, but what it really was there was one vote per household. And this is where I get so frustrated with, you know, the interpretation of history, like, oh, we were so sexist, which now, as you all know, is the big buzzword, is, you know, sexism, racism. It's spewed so much, it's now nauseating. But women, the reason women went and got the right to vote is all their husbands had died in the Civil War, and they didn't have a vote. So they had to get the right to vote because many of them didn't have husbands. And we're talking 700,000 men died at a time when the population of our country was around 16 to 18 million. And as I've seen done mathematically, the men that were fighting the war were childbearing age, father-aged men. If you take a country of 16 million or 18, say 17 million, you know that half of those people... Well, we'll do it this way. We know that they say on average half of those people are either too elderly or too infantile to lead. So that takes 17 million and it drops it to 8.5 million. And we know half of those people are female and half are male. So we take half of that off, which drops us down to just over 4 million people. Or 4 million men, I'm sorry. And we know that out of 4 million men that we consider to be, you know, of the age to bear children or lead a family, we lost almost 20% of them. That's one out of every five families lost a father. And what I think is hard for that, and actually the math doesn't quite work like that, it's a little more than that because the families were more consolidated. They had more kids. Every family lost male leadership is what happened. The few men that survived the Civil War were very lucky. And so we got to a point, long story short, where the ladies had to do these kinds of things. But this also led up to some of our currency confusion because we had issued so much fiat currency under Abraham Lincoln. In the 1870s, some of the men that remained demanded that we paid the debt off. Once we did that, the country was in bad shape. Again, men started to kind of grow up a little bit. By the 1890s, but they hadn't exactly, you know, had the exposure to adult leadership from other males and old school constitutionalists, etc. So what happened is they started to see a lot of bank failures, a lot of depressions and recessions and hyperinflation messes with the economy because they were tampering with our economy. We weren't producing like we used to. There was just a lot of dystopia going on. And the central banks started to really make people mad, centralized banking, and they wanted banking that would disperse the responsibility, disperse authority. And believe it or not, out of that came the Federal Reserve Act, which the four most wealthy men in the world, which comprised up to half of the world's wealth, got together and wrote this thing. They backed it. They created it. It was a farce. It was, to me, a fantasy. It was like sitting around and saying, what if, I mean, what if I could make my own pink currency and tell everybody, this is the money you're going to use, and you have to give me your real wealth to get it. So I say, here's a bunch of these pink notes. I'll take your gold. I'll take your horses. I'll take your land. You know, you loan out the pink notes. You get collateral. You trade the pink notes for gold, etc. Well, this is what these guys did. They couldn't get it through. People were mad. They were like, no way. We're not going to go with decentralized banking. They kept trying and trying and repackaging it. They first tried to push the bill through on a Republican basis. It didn't fly. Then they started to try to recruit the liberals or the left, the Democrats. And what eventually happened was they recruited a guy named Williams Jennings Bryan, who was a populist. He was a man who represented the working man. They conned him. They showed him this theory that fiat currency, Keynesian economics, would prevent all future inflation, all future deflation. Everything would be standard, that they could expand and retract the currency, and these problems would never happen again. Williams Bryan Jennings was not an economist. He didn't know any better to ask the right questions, and he believed them. And he convinced the people of the United States to kind of stand behind it. It was the Federal Reserve Act was passed on Christmas Eve of 1913 by an emergency meeting of Congress of 11 members. Okay, these 11 members knew exactly what they were doing and why they were doing it. Okay, they knew that they had money. They had big stakes in the game. So they pushed it through. Since then, the Federal Reserve Act has been amended almost 300 times. So it's kind of like what they thought they were going to do with Obamacare. And it's been amended and amended and amended to the point where we have an IRS who has more power than any other authority in the United States of America. They can do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, with impunity. We have, the Federal Reserve, which is neither federal nor a reserve. The Federal Reserve owns all of our assets. It's traded all of our assets for worthless paper money. Our paper money now is a promise from a bank. FDR came into office when we had hyper. So the Federal Reserve went into effect. By the way, you're listening to Coins Plus, or True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor, sponsored by Coins Plus. Coins Plus can be reached 444-0044 locally or outside the area, toll-free 877-TAP-COIN, 877-827-2646. All shows come through our website, previously recorded radio shows at coinsplus.com. We've had, as usual, I've been struggling with uploading a little bit. I think I got them all up now. So anyway, the Federal Reserve Act was instantly started this process. They had one goal, and that was to get people to accept the currency. Americans at this time knew gold and they knew silver. Gold notes and silver notes even spooked them a little bit because they knew in the past things had gone under. However, it had been a while since this occurred. So what they did, and they say accidentally or out of expediency, whatever it may be, on the new Federal Reserve notes, they just changed the old national bank notes to Federal Reserve bank notes. And what that means is they took these old bank notes that said, you know, the First Bank of Nebraska, you know, the Union State Bank of Kansas, there's thousands and thousands of them. And they just went and they got rid of the charter number on the note and they stamped Federal Reserve at the top instead of national currency. People didn't catch it. Also, they had little clauses that said things like this note is redeemable in gold or or silver. So it made people feel warm and fuzzy inside. They thought, well, nothing's changed. So as a result, what people began to do was two things happened. One, they began to deposit their gold and silver and operate more heavily on this new Federal Reserve notes. Two was debt. prior to the Federal Reserve Act, debt was very scarce, few and far between. People used it. There weren't, you know, the great lending protection laws. They're better and better now than they've ever been. It's getting to the excess now where people, you know, criticize banks for foreclosing on properties, which is just idiotic. I mean, they have to do it. I'll talk about that here in a minute. But anyway, they got people to start borrowing money. The concept was to expand and retract currency, right? Now, you got to remember, our currency system that we had adopted, that was essentially adopted by the 8 or 4 richest men in the world, was created initially designed by John Maynard Keynes. Okay, that's why we call it Keynesian economics. John Maynard Keynes was a dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore student of Leninist Marxism. Hardcore Marxist. He said, quote, "This when he created this currency system in a contest. The contest was to create a way to effectually take over the economic system in favor of socialism." So they wanted, and it was at Oxford or something, they wanted someone to create a system that would get people in, because see, socialism's all about your money. You can hear about this, you know, taken from the rich, given to the poor, Robin Hood, redistribution of wealth, you name it. But the truth of the matter is, it's the government desiring to confiscate your wealth. It's not all this pretty picture about spreading the wealth around and sharing. It's not about charity. And you cannot have socialism effectually work if people have wealth. So you've got to strip away their wealth. This is a fact. This is why this nation has undergone this hyperinflation. This is why Barack Hussein Obama produced currency like at levels no one can comprehend. I've had liberals say, well, you know, the way it works is at first you spend all that money and all that debt, and then over time it pays you back. I had a guy say that to me one day, and I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, it's what it is it's, you know, you invest all that money, and then in time it pays you. I'm like, whatever, dude. You're out to lunch. So, and by the way, it doesn't work that way. That's why Barack Hussein Obama was pumping currency out. He's got to hyperinflate, reduce the currency, make us compatible at a third world level. The problem is Americans are innovative and hardworking, and we just don't quit, and we've got initiative and instinct, and we've been through a lot, and we keep continuing to drive, and luckily our older generations, you know, they stay the course. Everybody would like a break. A lot of people's lives are hard, and they want, you know, they want a free lunch. I mean, let's admit it. So they vote for lie after lie after lie because they hope, and these people, these professional politicians, are fantastic liars. That's why Donald Trump is blowing their mind. He's doing everything he said he was going to do. So back to the Federal Reserve Act. They began to lend money like crazy. They made it easy to get, like beyond your wildest dreams. And interest rates at the time were very, very low. Initially, like in the 1920s, I think they were down around 2% and 3%. I'm looking at a chart here. Real quick, if I recall properly, and we've got a dragging internet system here. Interest rates in the 1920s, mortgage rates were like 2%, okay? So the bottom line is they made it real easy to get. People had never borrowed money, and as they began to infuse this money into the economy, and people still had their gold and silver that the government was trying to get out of them because they thought it was okay because they had the they had the gold claws on the note, so they thought everything was good. So they continued to function the same way they had. So what you ended up with was a combination of gold and silver floating around along with real gold and silver notes and this new fiat currency. So we got a double infusion. We began to create this fiat currency on top of the old currency, on top of it. And people were borrowing money and building businesses, and America began to grow. We had the Roaring Twenties. In a way, folks, probably one of the most beautiful architectural times in the history of the United States. The way women dressed was fantastic. The way our buildings were designed was fantastic. If you've ever been in the Davenport Hotel downtown in Spokane, it's a historic hotel, beautiful. That is the Roaring Twenties. Cars got fancy, chrome got hot, jewelry got big, money was flowing, okay? So we had a good time in this country. Money was flowing, and this was the original insurgence of capital into our system. It was all artificial. It was faith in the dollar that drove this. They knew the dollar was strong. Money was easy to get. It was good in their minds, in the consumer's mind. So what comes next is in the late 20s now, everything's getting overbought. The Fed has pumped out all the currency it can. The markets and economy begin to stretch. There's no more room to grow. It was saturated. People begin to default on their debts. They begin rewriting loans. They just can't make ends meet. There's not enough. The market overgrows. There's too many businesses. The Fed overstimulated the market with artificial currency. Because it wasn't stimulated with real hard assets, like as if you dug oil or gold, and if we found the biggest store of gold in the world, and everybody was getting rich because of this gold, that is permanent, timeless wealth. That is wealth that is sustainable. This was not sustainable. So the banks were in a bad spot. And what they did, and they'd also realized that they had absconded a considerable amount of the gold. One of the problems was we started paying off World War I debt. We had debt with other countries. We were debt crazy. The government began to live by its mantra of debt. We had other countries that wanted to get repaid, but they wanted to get repaid in gold. We started to look around and say, hey, we've got a problem. The Federal Reserve had released about a 33-to-1 ratio of gold notes to the entire reserve of gold that this country owned, which at the time was like 6,000 some metric tons, exactly the same amount they report today. Hypothetically, it's never changed, and there's a reason for that. All that wealth has officially been transferred to the Fed. It's been assigned to other countries. It's got dual ownership, but not ours. So we're being lied to. People say, is there gold in Fort Knox? Yeah, there actually is, but it's not ours. That's the crazy part. They argue about whether or not it's there, but it's not ours. That's why people say audit the Fed. We need to know their true asset base. What's their real profitability? What are they really doing to people? We need to know. And the Fed will basically let people say anything about it they want until they actually begin to threaten their existence, and then they crush. Kind of like the Von Nauthaus guy about 10 years ago that was making Liberty dollars. He was creating a currency that competed with the Federal Reserve. Hypothetically, on paper, he should have been fine. Men in black jackets showed up when he got a shipment back of all his platinum and silver and all these new coins, and he had 10 and 20 and $100 coins. Men in black showed up at his business and confiscated upon delivery of all this stuff they'd been watching. They didn't even identify who they were. It took him and his attorney almost a year to figure out to get anyone to even respond. Once they discovered whoever it was, which is yet to be disclosed, they just say the federal government, then he got charged with counterfeiting and all this stuff, even though what he was making looked nothing like anything that's circulating. The problem that he had, in my opinion, was he used the word dollars on his coins. It shouldn't have been a threat to our government, candidly. This has been done many, many times in the past. There's many territorial gold coins out there from Pikes Peak in California, or not, you know, Pikes Peak in Denver or in Colorado, but then the California Gold Rush. There's all kinds of situations where competing currencies have been created. But post-fiat currency, post-Federal Reserve, we've really lost our minds. So the banks began to retract the currency, pull it back in, tighten up their lending standards, call notes due. They had laws that completely favored them. You've probably seen the old stories about the families that own the big farms, and the banker would show up and say, "We're taking it." And they'd be like, "But wait, you know, I'm going to make the payment. It's only been 10 days. And they'd say, "Too bad. We have that right. Look at your banknote." And this is where the banks began to get very, very rich. Before this, other than world central banks, banking and bankers in general weren't the filthy rich that they are now. So they would begin to foreclose on people's properties or rewrite notes at interest rates that were unsustainable, take serious advantage of people, sign people up on loans they couldn't understand because they were uneducated, and they'd have huge loan fees and prepayment penalties, many situations where banks would accelerate the note and another bank might pick it up, but they'd have so many prepayment penalties and points and fees that it was impossible to pay it off. It was a very bad time. This is when you began to see people jumping out of buildings on Wall Street. This is the crash of 29. And what really fueled that was margin buying. And the way margin buying works is if you have, let's just say, $100,000, it doesn't matter. It could be $10,000 or $1,000, but I'll use $100,000 because it's an easy number to understand. You have $100,000 in your investment account with Charles Schwab or Morgan Stanley or you know, whoever it may be, Merrill Lynch, whatever. You have $100,000, let's say, in real money you've put in there, fiat currency, whatever, in your money market. You can have it in stocks, bonds, whatever. You can margin that money. That means you can borrow against it to buy more stock. So here's what happens. It depends on what area of equity you invest in. Some are up to 70%, well, more now, like 60, 40 to 60% margin. So if you're buying high-risk stock, they might loan you up to 40% of your current holdings. If you're buying conservative treasury bonds, up to 60%. So what happens is this. You have a portfolio of $100,000, and you're allowed to borrow another $50,000, say, and buy more stock. However, the percentage is based on your original holdings. So if you have $100,000 in stock and you leverage another $50,000 on margin, and then the market begins to come down, your $100,000 drops to, say, $90,000, that triggers a margin call. That means the banks say, "Look, we loaned you 50% of the amount you had with us. That amount is dropping now, and you're exceeding the 50% limit. You're maybe approaching 55 or 60. They have thresholds. And so we will instantly sell the stocks on margin." And what happens is, so a guy that had, you know, $100,000 in the account and $50,000 on margin, all of a sudden, as it comes down, the margin calls are forcing the sale of all this stock, which in turn crashes the market further. So first they lose, say you had $100,000 invested and $50,000 on margin. Say the market dropped real fast, 20%. Your $100,000 is $80,000 and your $50,000 is $30,000. Well, you have to pay $50,000 back out of the $30,000, so they're now you're down to $80,000. They take another $20,000 to balance out the $50,000 you borrowed, and you only have $30,000 left. So now your $100,000 is down to $60,000. You're sitting there with $60,000. Everybody else's margin calls are coming due. The stocks that you are holding are begin dropping like a rock. And all of a sudden, overnight, people lost everything. The market just plummeted. It's caused by margins. And this actually, to this day, affects metals prices a lot. People buy futures a lot on margin. Margin investing is just really high risk and really stupid. People don't understand. They think, well, I have $100,000, I can make this much. If I have $150,000, I can make 50% more. That's actually assuming that you're going to gain and not lose. With margins, if you're going up, everything's fine. If it's coming down, the market explodes. So on the crash of 29, this thing started to come apart. People were killing themselves because all their money was gone overnight. And you know what that means, all the debt on their mortgages, their business, all the bills that were due, everything overnight gone. Money is gone. They didn't have the bankruptcy laws then that we had for many years. Now our bankruptcy laws are a bit more stringent where you at least have to prove you're bankrupt. You used to, for many years when I was in banking, anybody could file bankruptcy for any reason at any time. You didn't have to prove anything. Now you've got to prove something. And now you also have some accountability. But back then, it was reckless. Banks could just come and clean you out. In fact, many debts were imprisonable. You could be locked up for not paying your debts. In some cases, that's probably not the worst thing ever. But in other cases, it's civil and not criminal, and they treat it as such. So this was a simultaneous attempt to abscond the wealth of Americans, increasing the wealth of the bankers. You got to remember, J.P. Morgan was one of the four that created the Federal Reserve Act. He also created the Dow and the New York Stock Exchange. He was making all of his money on fees. He was also on the inside of everything. He was an owner in the Federal Reserve Bank. He knew what was happening before it happened. 5 days before the stock market crash of 29, all four of the gentlemen who were part of the Federal Reserve and their close buddies cashed out of all their stock and moved into gold. Because foreign nations wanted to be paid their debt paid back in gold, our government used this vehicle through the Federal Reserve to abscond the wealth of Americans and transfer it to the Federal Reserve bankers, and also to get people to cash their gold and silver in, to not think they had redeemable gold and silver notes. They immediately began cashing everything in. FDR came out and said, look, we've got an issue. We need more gold for to back the bank, to back the currency. And he asked people to patriotically turn their gold in. And it didn't work crazy. The reason that they were doing this primarily is they owed all this debt to foreign nations. Foreign nations wanted gold. And FDR became aware of the fact that the Fed had created, with the government's assistance, 33 times the gold-backed notes as we had in reserve to back it up. So when all these foreign nations were holding our gold notes saying, I want my gold, we did not have the gold to give. So they collapsed the market. They began to get people to force their gold back in. They had two options. One, admit the fraud, or two, do this huge Ponzi scheme. Well, the Ponzi scheme got people to start turning their gold. After they got to a certain amount, he created an executive order and said, look, it's illegal, hypothetically, to own gold bullion products, especially foreign gold, which is why when people say, well, I've got the pre-1933 British sovereigns, or I've got the pre-1933 Swiss 20 francs, these were exempt from confiscation because they're pre-33. No. In FDR's executive order, the only thing that he exempted from confiscation was pre-33 U.S. gold. And the reason we call it pre-33 is only because the law was written in 33. It applied to all U.S. legal tender currency gold coins. They were exempt, primarily because we had never obsoleted our currency before or since then. They were legal tender. They were made to spend, and they were legal to hang on to. Also, because FDR was a collector, and he had a spectacular collection of coins, and many of the high-ranking politicians and dignitaries over the prior century or more had unbelievable coins because the U.S. Treasury director would mint them special coins or make special errors. They would literally mint things hypothetically illegally, but they had a lot of secret covert authority, which has been taken away from them since then. So a lot of the uber famous numismatic one-off coins that exist in our industry were created back then under those situations. So after the Federal Reserve, after the executive order of 33, when they began to confiscate gold to buy it back at $20 a troy ounce, and they began to see this dilapidate, slow down, the gold was, you know, not coming in very fast, they estimated that they'd gotten 80 to 85% of the outstanding bullion in existence. 85% is about what I've heard. So 85% of that gold is now in, of the gold in total existence in the U.S. is now in the hands of the U.S. government by probably 1930, late 33, 34. At this point in time, the government chooses, FDR, to change the gold price from $20 an ounce to $35 a troy ounce, instantly making the government 75% more wealthy because their gold just went up. What it did to the consumer was it took a banknote that was worth 1 ounce of gold and made it worth 60% of an ounce of gold. And so suddenly these people's buying power, you can call gold whatever you want per ounce, but over time it maintains its spending power. People say over time an ounce of gold would always buy a nice men's suit and shoes and a tie and dinner out or whatever. However you want to calculate it, gold maintains its spending power no matter how it's valued. So at this time, the government increased the value of their gold and decreased the value of the consumer's paper money holdings. And that is when, you know, and then the gold standard, we remain on the gold standard, but it was illegal to own gold bullion. The old U.S. $20 gold pieces, $10, all the numismatic face value stuff remain legal to own. Many people turned it in naively, ignorantly over the years, thinking they're being patriotic. But that's how many of these coins have been preserved. And that's why many people like pre-1933 U.S. gold. If we ever went back to any of these executive orders or a gold standard or whatever, because they were made as legal tender face value coinage, people are comfortable with the fact that they'll always remain such exempt. If they ever became non-exempt, it would absolutely turn the world upside down because legal tender face value would begin to lose its meaning. And, you know, I think you get my point. In 1971, we had existed for about 40 years without circulating gold, hypothetically, and we did continue to circulate silver. In the 60s, we began to pull silver out of the coinage. That was something that happened after Kennedy passed. And what was going on there was Kennedy understood the Federal Reserve Act, the damage it was doing to this country, the way it was fleecing America. John F. Kennedy, a different kind of a Democrat, trust me, had an executive order in place to put through to immediately abolish the Federal Reserve. He was going to destroy the Federal Reserve, and he was going to convert us to U.S. legal tender notes, the old red seal $2 and $5 bills. We have packs of these old notes for sale. Some people like to get them. They're dated either 1953 or 63. We do have them from 1928, but they're quite a bit more expensive. 53s and 63s run for a $2 bill, red seal, very pretty note, by roughly $5 a piece. They can be more in quality. But we do sell those in quantity if people want to come and buy some as a little relic of history. There's all kinds of old banknotes. They're very collectible. The Red Seal and Blue Seal silver certificates from the 60s aren't overly collectible. But when you get into the old U.S. paper money, they're incredibly collectible, phenomenally good investments. They've done tremendously well over time. They're absolutely gorgeous. And we have a large number of them certified by an independent third party grading service. They're encapsulated in a hard plastic shell and so on. But anyway, Kennedy had his executive order ready to go to abolish the Fed. He was assassinated. And we were on the road to socialism. And because of that, it was done by the Federal Reserve, I believe, the world's central bankers. Immediately, LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, stepped in behind him, and he began to eradicate all these acts that JFK was about to put through. Our country would be in a different position had he done that. In addition to that, then in 71, we had Nixon remove us officially from the gold standard and deregulate the prices of gold and silver. This is when we began to see hyperinflation take off. We saw the artificial oil crunch where OPEC started to play games with us. And then we began to see gold and silver rise in price from 1971 until, you know, in the 40 years following 1971, we saw gold and silver go up, you know, 4,500% in 40 years. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that's 100% a year. Even if it's 4,000 divided by 40 years, that's $100 a year. Compounded, it was like 20-some percent a year. So this is what precious metals have done over time. And this is why you want them. The long-term trend is good. So we went off of that. We basically got to a point. The second surge was under Clinton. I'm getting short on time. Under Clinton, we had our stock market began to draw in currency from all around the world. We had our second big fiat currency surge. We began to get income revenue from all around the world into our markets at a time when they were arguing about surpluses. This is a time when we could have, again, paid off all the U.S.'s Federal Reserve debt. That was the last time that will ever happen. The liberals refused. They wanted to spend the money. They're idiots. They don't want to give it back to the people. They don't trust the people. They want to defund the people's pocketbooks, folks. They want to redistribute wealth. They want you broke. Don't be fooled otherwise. When they say they're trying to help the working man, to do what? Get a $15 an hour minimum wage? I mean, yeah, if you're making minimum, that's nice. But they don't want to make you wealthy. America is a country of opportunity. Donald Trump is going to relieve 75% of regulations. That makes it so possible for so many people to open businesses. This is a totally different mindset that is now very difficult to comprehend because these news channels, news stations are so used to pumping out fake news, which Karl Marx clearly educated people to do. He said, you know, use the media as your propaganda tool. That's how communism is supposed, or Marxism, whatever you want to call it, is supposed to take over society. Brainwash the children, commandeer the media, the press at the time, which was a newspaper, pump out false reports that are pro-government, anti-resistance, and there you go. So we're coming into a point now, folks, where Obama has hyperinflated currency beyond your dreams, beyond the realm. The level of debt we owe is insurmountable and unpayable. There is no turning back. Our deficit alone is $67,000 for every man, woman, and child. When you go to unfunded liabilities, you're in the millions of dollars per tax-paying citizen. It's absolutely unheard of. Now Donald Trump wants a weak dollar policy. He's saying that because he knows it's necessary for trade, but also because that's the inevitable outcome of what Obama's done. Folks, despite people thinking partisan politics, Obama devastated the economy in the United States. He devastated our position in the world. We've operated from a position of weakness, not a position of strength. We've led from behind. Even though Donald Trump is doing all the right things, he's coming in to fix the problem. Think of it as a company in severe distress. The only difference is it's riding on all of our backs and we can see the train coming. Financial chaos most likely lies ahead, 99.8% chance. We have the right man at the helm, but that doesn't mean there isn't strain and trial coming up. You've seen the markets explode with the Trump pump. This is the ideal moment for you to get out of a 401k. Whether you want to transfer that over to precious metals, we will do that for you. If you've called before, we had a little bit ago, I lost a couple notes. Please call back if you haven't heard back or you weren't able to get it dealt with. We do this on a daily basis. We also help people roll out. We can talk to you all about that. And whether you have savings, any money you want to preserve, you only want to preserve in metals-based assets the money you cannot afford to lose. I mean, if you've got money you want to go gamble with in the market, you can afford to lose it. That's your business. But if you want to hold it in a long-term biblical financial the correct way, and I can defend that biblically all day long, call us at 444-0044 or toll-free 877-TAP-COIN, 877-827-2646, or through our website at coinsplus.com. We will take care of you. We build wonderful portfolios. We have hand-selected items. We're very good at it. Our strategy works. It's proven true over decades. We've outperformed every other market out there, and people love the gold and silver. We do a lot of that, but we like to balance you out a little bit with items that will perform extraordinarily well over time. And trust me, once you become comfortable with what we do, you would understand. So really, folks, we're facing a great time. Even if you rolled out some of your 401k, you got 16 months before the taxes are due. Again, just give us a call. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend. And please consider, doing the right thing financially. Don't wait till it's too late. Take care. God bless and bye-bye. And thanks again.